Welcome to episode 66 of the Historic Performance Podcast featuring Cameron Jose, Director of Sports Performance at DeFranco's Gym at the Allen Academy in Austin, Texas. A big thank you to Dr. Corey Peacock for the recommendation. He is the exercise physiologist and sports performance coach for the Black Zillions mixed martial arts team down in Florida. He stated that Cameron is not only a fellow colleague, but someone that he greatly respects in the industry. And to say the least, Cameron did not disappoint. It was great to get someone who works with such high-level American football players at a well-respected private facility here in the United States, such as DeFranco's Gym in Texas. And in this episode, Cameron talks about the training methodology and principles that are utilized at DeFranco's Gym in Texas, Dr. Spina's FRC system, and how they have placed an importance of training mobility as a biomotor ability. And finally, about the 1080 motion, and specifically 1080 quantum, and how they have integrated that in their program design, as well as a fairly interesting case study. So I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. Let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. This evening, I'm really happy to be joined by Cameron Jose. He is the Director of Performance down at DeFranco's Gym at Onnit Academy. Cameron, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Could you start us off by just telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So my background with DeFranco's really started back when I was 17 years old. I was playing high school football and I was looking for some sort of organized training. So I went on the computer and I kind of Googled just some local gyms that were nearby, and I came across DeFranco's, and I actually had a couple teammates in high school that had trained there before, and I asked them about it, and then that's when they said, oh yeah, you got to go check that place out. It's right down the street from where we live. And I was very fortunate that the gym was only about 10 minutes down the highway from where I was living at the time. So I went in there and met with Joe and got started with training. And it was one of those things where my first couple months there, I just saw tremendous gains in what I was doing in the gym. And I went from 165 pounds in March of that year to 192 pounds in August when I weighed in for football. I think I like to credit how one of the things I wasn't doing at all was any form of leg work. And it's funny because I went over there, and obviously training for football, you need to do a lot of legs. And I remember he got me doing a lot of legs, and my legs just exploded. You know, I remember having to get new pant sizes and things like that. So I started by basically being sort of a student of just being in his program. So I was just one of his athletes and really bought into the program that he was doing. And it was something that I thought was great. And you're surrounded by people, you know, in the environment that Joe DeFranco built at his gym was just something that was addictive, where you would go to the gym and everybody there has a very similar purpose for being there. They all want to get better and they all want to improve. And they're basically just doing whatever Joe tells them to do or one of Joe's coaches. And it was something that I just immediately got addicted to and just fell in love with. And so much so, in fact, that I decided when I was going to go to college that I wanted to study kinesiology and exercise science. So that's sort of how I ended up looking into the University of Rhode Island, because I saw that they had a highly regarded kinesiology program in the Northeast. So I had applied there and I got in, and I ended up going there to play football as well, which was something that DeFranco's helped me with. The improvements that I was able to make training under Joe, I think, really allowed me to make it to that point where I was capable of playing at University of Rhode Island on the football team. When I was there my major was in exercise science and kinesiology. And when I would come back home during the summers from school, I asked Joe if he was cool with me interning with him, basically, or just kind of shadowing and seeing what all the coaches there were doing and trying to learn more about the practical application of the exercise science. So in school, we were learning a lot of the theoretical, a lot of the research, and, you know, a lot of the book oriented stuff. But it was cool for me to spend the school year learning about that stuff and then coming back in the summers, going back to the gym that I loved being at and trained at. And then also, you know, when I was done training for the day, I would just stay there, just kind of shadow Joe for the remainder of the day for hours after training, and just would bring meals with me. And it was something that was cool for me to observe because I got to see more of the hands-on approach to it. And I learned real quick about what it takes to deal with athletes and their personalities and their temperaments and a lot of the psychology that goes into it as well. So it was something that I was exposed to pretty early by shadowing Joe, is learning how to deal with people and especially athletes and what they go through. And also a lot of professional athletes, because he was training a lot of NFL players at the time. So I got to be exposed to that, which was pretty cool for a college undergrad to have that exposure. During my senior year at URI, that's when we were required to do an internship. So I figured I would branch away from DeFranco's a little bit and try going and doing an internship in the collegiate sector. So that's when I ended up at University of South Carolina, because one of my former strength coaches that I had at University of Rhode Island, Mike Siriano, who's the head strength coach at Appalachian State right now, he was the assistant strength coach at that time at University of South Carolina. And he was working under Coach Joe Connolly, who is now the head guy at UMass, University of Massachusetts. And so I went down to South Carolina for a semester, and I was there for probably 4 to 5 months, working primarily with the football team. Also got some exposure with the soccer team and the track and field. So that was a pretty cool experience as well. And I kind of reached this point where when I was doing that internship, I didn't know if I wanted to stay in the college sector or if I wanted to maybe do something in the private sector, which is what DeFranco's was. So I remember I called Joe and I basically just had a conversation with him, and I asked him, you know, what he thought that I should do, just from, you know, a mentorship standpoint, like what he would recommend I do with my career and where I want to take it. He was real cool about it. I mean, he just talked to me on the phone for almost an hour, just kind of weighing the options and talking about the pros and cons and how he had dabbled a little bit into looking at the college sector and the professional setting and why he kind of opted to stay in the private sector. But he kind of, you know, really weighed the pros and cons of both options. And it wasn't until the end of the conversation, which would have made the conversation easier if he had started with this, but he ended up saying, well, you know, I'm thinking about maybe bringing another guy on to kind of help out this summer. And he's like, what do you think? Is it something you'd be interested in? And I, you know, here I am, the guy's asking me if I want to go to the place that was basically my sanctuary in high school and in my summers during college. And I was like, of course, like, hell yeah, I'm interested. So I agreed that that's what I wanted to do. So when I finished up at South Carolina, I ended up graduating from URI with my bachelor's degree. And that's when I started just working for Joe right after that. So, and it was one of those things where he didn't take me in and sit me down and say, look, this is how we program, this is how we do this, this is how we do that. He basically just said, you got to find your own clients. You need to figure out how you want to program for them. And here you go. Like, I'm setting you free. Like, you're out of the nest now. So I think that from his standpoint, I think he knew that I had been shadowing him just for 4 years while I was in college. And I'd been a part of the program the entire time since I had started with him at age 17. And was very familiar with the way they were doing things. And I think that was where he sort of had that confidence in me, where he felt like he didn't really have to say anything or guide me too much, because I had already sort of gone through that rite of passage by being around the gym for so many years. But it certainly was a wake-up call for me. So it was one of those things where immediately it humbled me to be there and realizing, wow, you know, designing a program for somebody and making sure that everything is accounted for to the best of my knowledge is really hard. You know, it's something that's not, it's by far not the easiest thing that a coach can go through the first time, but it is necessary in order to really learn how to do it. So I definitely appreciate the fact that he sort of threw me to the fire, if you will, and forced me to adapt on the spot and learn how to create programs, how to deal with athletes that I'm actually coaching, not shadowing with him. So now that he's basically taken the training wheels off, now it's like, okay, now I'm the coach. So I'm not an intern anymore. I'm the guy. And that was just a really cool experience to learn how to do that. So I worked with him for about a year and a half in New Jersey, learning my own management style and sort of how to program for athletes. And that's when he took me aside and said that he was thinking about moving the gym down to Austin and kind of partnering up with the company on it, asked me if I would be interested in going down there and running the DeFranco's program in Austin. And when he first asked me that, I was like, whoa, you know, I just got here and I'm only about a year and a half into this. And I was like, I don't know, you know, at first, but I went home that night and I thought about it. And that's when I realized that he's only asking me that because he had the confidence in me and he trusted that I would be able to hold up his name to the way that he wanted it to be represented. At that stage, I took that as a big honor for me. And it hit me like, okay, you know what? Maybe I can do this. Like, there's no reason why I can't. And it's going to be a huge adjustment, but yeah, let's do it. So I told him, yeah, I'll go down to Austin. Let's do it. And so that's when I moved down to Austin. I've been here about almost 2 years now. And he named me DeFranco's director of sports performance down here in Austin. And it was another stage of being thrown into the fire because not only did I have to learn how to really coach athletes and program and everything that goes into that, but I actually had to learn how to manage business and how to run successful operations. And that was the biggest adjustment for me because in school I had studied exercise science. So I kind of was familiar with it. And then I had interned with Joe. So the coaching and the programming and stuff was becoming more comfortable to me, but the business side, I'd never even looked into any of that. So that was a huge adjustment for me, was trying to do that. You know, luckily it wasn't completely me by myself, since we're attached to the Onnit Academy, that they sort of just had their own operations of how they were doing things. And then that was able to keep the roof over our head and all that. So that's where I was able to take the time to learn how to take into account business and things like that. And that's a big reason why I ended up hiring our director of operations for the DeFranco side, who is also my girlfriend, Jennifer Andrews. She's been a huge godsend to me because she's been able to take the operational side off my plate. So now I can go back to focusing mostly on coaching. But before she got there, I had to learn how to do it. And I didn't do a great job of it, but I did a decent enough job where I kept DeFranco's in the picture. So it was that was the biggest adjustment for me, was going into learning how to not only run the training, but also how to run the business side of it. So but that's sort of the story of how I ended up down here. And, you know, we're still trying to go strong right now. And, you know, here we are and trying to make good strides.
No doubt about it. It sounds like you're wearing many different hats during your time out there, and that it was a great learning experience and continues to be a good learning experience for you.
Absolutely.
For those that may not know Joe DeFranco, what type of athletes is he known for training, and what does your typical clientele look like down in Texas?
Well, being in Texas, our biggest clientele is football. So that's, and you know, American football is the biggest clientele that we have in Texas. It's the biggest sport in this state. So it actually worked out pretty well, because in New Jersey, that ended up being Joe's most popular sport for the clientele that he had in New Jersey. So coming down here, we were very familiar with football, and you know, Joe played football previously. I played football previously. So I would say that's our biggest clientele, but we have a very broad range of clientele, spanning from when Joe is in New Jersey to where we are in Austin right now. And I mean, you can almost name the sport, and Joe or I have worked with that sport. So it's something where we like to make it known that we don't specialize in one sport versus another. We want to have the experience of working with all these different sports. And being in New Jersey, for example, I had an experience where a guy came over from Denmark and he was a handball player. And that was something where I never thought that I would train a European handball player in New Jersey. but it happened. And it was because of the outreach that Joe has. And, you know, we've trained baseball players, basketball players, lacrosse players, hockey players. Like I said, you name the sport, and we've worked with them before. Joe's now very heavily associated with the WWE as well. So he's done a lot with guys trying to become professional wrestlers and consulting with them. And obviously he's worked with Triple H one-on-one with his training for, I think, at least 5 years. I don't even know how it's been a couple of years now. Being here in Austin, I had the experience of working with The Undertaker, prepping him for this last WrestleMania. And, you know, at 50 years old, he came to me and wanted me to train him. So that was a pretty cool experience as well. And being in Austin here and associated with Onnit, their following is very heavily associated with UFC and MMA fighters. So that gives me a little bit of exposure to those type of clientele as well. And it's just one of those situations where we just really want to make it known that we're here for sports performance and whatever that sport is. And really what we're here for is goal performance. So even if you're not an athlete, we want to make sure that we put it out there that if you just have a goal, we want to help find a way to get you to that goal. So we're, you know, we call ourselves like director of sports performance or whatever, but really, if you have a goal and you want to reach it, whether it's sport related or not, if it's health related or whatever it is, like, we want to make sure that we're there to help you attain that. So that's sort of the message that we want to put out there. We want to cater to as many different clientele as we can so that it helps us learn and helps us grow and become more holistic overall.
Typically, when clients come to you with a specific goal, is it generally small windows that you have in order to improve upon? I can imagine with American football, especially with the college and professional level, they're coming to you during their off season. So I imagine you have a small window to accomplish a lot of things.
Yeah, we definitely, when it comes to the athletes, when they are at that advanced stage of either being higher level college athletes or professional athletes, our window is very small with those clientele. So we might have our NFL guys in the immediate off season. We might have them for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks if we're lucky before they go back for OTAs. And that's the organized team activities that they have to go back for. And then they come back again for the summer. But when they're back for the summer, they're only here for maybe another 6 to 8 weeks tops before they have to go back for training camp. So yeah, the window is pretty small for those guys. So we basically just have to focus on whatever we can during those time periods. So I heard an old quote by the Cardinals, Arizona Cardinals strength coach, Buddy Morris, where he just talks about how they always look at what they can and what they can't do on a daily basis. And they just try to make sure that whatever they can do, they will do. And whatever they can't do, they just don't do that. So that's sort of the same mindset and the approach that we take with our pro guys, is we just try to get what we can out of them and make improvements where we can and just hope for the best. And really at that stage, it's about just making sure that they can maintain a lot of the performance they've achieved, because they're already at such a high level of sporting mastery. So because they're at that professional level, we're just trying to make sure that they feel comfortable and they feel good and that they're still making incremental performance increases where possible. Even if it's just temporary, where they're sort of detrained after the season, and then we try to bring them back up to a trained state, and then they go back to for practice and they feel more like themselves, you know, whatever it takes to make sure that we make any kind of incremental improvement with them. That's really what we aim for.
As the director of sports performance down in Texas, you're in charge of training methodology and principles. And I was hoping to start off this conversation, if you could tell us a little bit about the fundamental principles that you have down there that influences program design and everything else that goes into enhancing athletic performance for the athletes.
Absolutely. And these are all principles that Joe and I share, as well as some that I hold true to myself and just sort of how I view things. And I would say stage one is we're very big on developing a solid foundation of general physical preparation, or GPP. So we want to make sure that we can maximize the trainability of general training means before we get too crazy about trying to go into advanced training methods. And we're not just talking about baseline strength improvements. I think that's something that needs to be said, is everybody always says, "Oh, just build strength first and everything else will improve." And obviously there's research to support it, but we're not just looking at building strength improvements, but we're also looking at building baseline acceleration and speed and power improvements as well. So that's another thing that we start right from the get-go. No matter if they're trained or untrained athletes, we want to make sure that we're maximizing those qualities, not just how strong they can get, but also immediately throwing them into teaching them how to sprint properly and how to jump properly. And that's something that I've seen Derek Hansen talk about, who's got a track and field background, but he's a guy that worked with Charlie Francis, the great track and field coach. And he mentioned, well, if we understand that, you know, strength is important at the beginning, well, why isn't speed important at the beginning? There's no reason why it isn't. It's something where you can start getting guys fast right away and teaching them how to sprint at really any age. So that's another thing that we've done with our GPP approach, is making sure that we are really hammering in developing acceleration qualities and power qualities from the get-go as well. And the basics go a very long way in the training process. And that's something that Joe's always preached to me, is keep things simple to the degree where you're just maximizing the basics. You don't have to do anything super crazy with what you're doing in the gym, as long as what you're doing is working and you're doing it well. So really trying to master the fundamentals and the basics, because they really do go much further than people think. And I think a lot of people try to dive into more of these fad type advanced training methods that are really made for, or really meant for, more advanced athletes. They're trying to do them with kids that are, they don't need them yet. You know, they can still make gains by doing very more general things. And another main principle that we try to preach is that we try to have our athletes learn how to perform movement safely before we apply great overload to them. So when they're in the early stages of learning, we want to make sure that they understand what we're asking of them and the intention of the movement before we apply overload to it. And that goes for any lift, and it also goes for, you know, sprinting. And we're not going to up the volume or throw a timing system out there right away if they don't have the technique down. So I'd rather take a guy and teach him how to sprint and make sure he's comfortable with it. Then we can speed it up, and now we can start timing him and start measuring his performance in that. But if I measure a sprint performance that is completely technically just a disaster, it's not going to tell me too much. I mean, it tells me how fast he can move from point A to point B, but like, there's no efficiency there. So I'd rather really dial in the efficiency and then start timing and overloading it. And one of the things I learned just from reading the Franz Bosch book that came out recently is how, and it's something that, you know, I've always seen as well, is how load can be, you can increase loading with weight, or you can increase loading with more coordination. And so that's another thing we'll do with our guys is try to put them in different situations and a little bit different environments and see how they handle that constraint and deal with the different coordinative aspects that go into that. And we don't do anything crazy. You know, it's just maybe something as simple as just switching the bar on a squat, or switching the starting position for a sprint, just little things that they have to try to adapt to. And it shows us whether or not they're really owning those movement patterns and mastering them to the point where they can use them in a wide variety of different environments, really, no matter what's being thrown at them. Because I've had plenty of athletes that they look great with a barbell squat, and then you put a safety bar on their back, and all of a sudden their squat looks awkward, or they're just very disoriented. Or if you give them a barbell squat and they're really good with that, and then you give them a barbell reverse lunge, all of a sudden being on one leg, it's just kind of like, whoa, you know, what's this? So I like kind of throwing different coordinative things at them, as well as different weights and different loading patterns. And another big principle that we preach is, and this is something that I learned from Dr. Andrea Ospina with his functional range conditioning certification, is that we need to treat mobility as a true biomotor quality. So we can't just assume that mobility is something that's kind of made for, oh, let's just put it in the warm up and then let's do the real training later. Let's just kind of put it in as like a separate routine. And you have to really treat that as an actual biomotor ability that's very important to performance. And that's something that I learned from that certification, was just how much you can get out of really challenging the strength of your tissues and their end range. And that's something that I had never really thought about before, where a lot of the things that we're doing in the gym or on the field or whatever, things that are more very closed in nature, very closed exercises, those things are putting us in very controlled settings. And also we're sort of working just the mid range of our body positions and our joint positions. So the FRC cert, it opened my eyes to realizing, well, I can keep my ankle neutral and build up all kinds of strength by doing lunges and things like that. But when I go to make a cut on a football field, do I have stability with my ankle completely rotated to one side versus the other? Or if I put my ankle in a sprained position that it's never been exposed to, is it going to rupture and get injured now as a result of, you know, just always being in sort of a neutral position and always in these mid-range joint positions? And that's where the FRC cert was interesting, is basically one of the major things I got out of it is you want to make sure that you're training your strength capabilities at the end range of your mobility. So you can put your foot up on a box and then have it on the box there and set it to a point where you're at almost the limit of your mobility for just that hip flexion type of movement, and then try to lift your foot a little bit higher from there. So you're trying to create stability at that end range. So if you're ever in a position where, you know, you're in this weird end range sort of position, now your body has already developed some sort of stability in that position. And, you know, it's something that it's not going to completely prevent injury. There's no way, but at least you know that your body's been exposed to that type of an environment. And now you're building strength across all kinds of joint positions, not just doing mid-range things. And it's crazy when you do some of the stuff from that certification, because it ends up feeling like a max effort lift. Like it's, you have to really like put everything you have into it. And it's something that blows your mind, because it's just body weight, you know? And when you combine that with more traditional strength training measures and other types of training, I think it comes along really well. And I've seen our guys here have some pretty big improvements with doing some of the FRC stuff, because really it's just helping to improve their neurological efficiency. And it's just sort of reprogramming their nervous systems to tell them like, hey, it's okay to produce stability and produce force in these weird positions. Like it's okay to do that. You know, it's just, you're just trying to reprogram the nervous system to allow them to open up their movement capacity. So we really try to treat mobility as a true biomotor quality, and it's a part of the whole organic training process. So that kind of leads into another one of our principles, which is something that I hold very dear, which is I like to track some form of data on everything that I'm doing to some degree, so that it can help me paint a picture of what's happening. Whatever makes sense to me, if I want to track certain strength quality, certain power quality, speed quality, I want to make sure that I'm tracking what makes sense to me. And those variables might change as my education is improved, but I like to have some form of knowledge of what's going on. And I think it should always be present for the coach and the athlete. So it's important that they know where they're at certain stages as well. So they know that they're making improvements or that they're not making improvements, and you just keep everything honest between the two of you. And I think that's important. And one of the other things that Joe always stresses to the max is that we always try to over-deliver as best we can. Even if the athlete doesn't even realize that we're over-delivering, we want to over-deliver. So we want to make sure that they're getting something that is virtually unmatched, at least in our opinion. And we want to just try to deliver as much as we can. And if we're, through our continuing education, if we're finding ways that we can improve things better than we are right now, we're going to change things up and make sure we go that more optimal route. So it's one of those holy grail type of things where we're never going to find the answer that is the truest answer out there, but we're trying to get to the holy grail as best as we can. And I would say really the last thing is just something that I hold dear to myself, is just staying humble, you know, just trying to be as humble as you can. This, in this field, it's so easy to build up an ego, but, and try to assume that you're the best out there and that, you know, this guy doesn't know what he's doing and I know what I'm doing. And it's just, you got to stay humble, because at the end of the day, everybody brings something to the table, even when it seems like they don't. You know, at least what they're doing is they're showing you what you shouldn't do. So you're learning from everybody. And I think it's important to always continue to learn and just find ways to improve at all times.
Agreed. And I especially agree with the latter point, because I feel that many times in this industry, whether it be high performance or fitness, when a person disagrees with someone, they either don't try learning more about it, in which case you can't really develop a valid opinion of it. Or, as you mentioned, even if you disagree with it, you can figure out why you disagree with it. But too many people are very quick just to alienate and be like, well, you know, that sounds crazy, so I don't really need to learn about it. And it's detrimental to them. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, I think that one of my sort of mentors from a distance is Mladen Jovanovic, who's got that complimentarytraining.net. And his whole principled approach on that website is not to have polarized thinking. Like, you don't want to be like, don't ever do this and only do this, but rather understand where everything falls into the balance and how you want to take that complementary approach to everything. And everything sort of works, but only in certain degrees and at certain situations. And I think that for any kind of coach to just polarize themselves into saying, I'm never going to do that, or I'm never going to do this, like, they're only limiting themselves. Exactly what you just said.
Yeah, and he's really a fantastic resource. Cameron, one area that I really want to follow up on is the emphasis that you're now putting on in terms of objective data, so you can look at it and see if progress is being made. And I know from our conversations prior to the podcast, this is something that's continuing to evolve on your end, but perhaps you could narrow it down and just tell us what you're doing with your more advanced level American football players in terms of trying to create a performance profile for them, you know, in terms of what type of objective data are you collecting, why you feel those metrics are important, and then what you're trying to get from it.
Yeah, so we keep all of our programs and our data in the team builder program. It's something that's cloud-based, and it allows us to completely customize our workouts, completely customize our exercises, and also customize what we want to track. And we can plug all of the numbers that we need to into that program. So that's been great for us. You know, when it comes to strength data, when we're doing strength work, we're just looking at the weights lifted that on each and every exercise. So not just max effort work, but also the assistance work, because we think that if we can look at improvements anywhere, it'll tell us something. So if we can aim to, if we have a day where maybe we're sort of staying the same with a max effort lift or just within the ballpark of what we're doing with our higher CNS strength work, but our assistance work is continuing to go up, then we know theoretically we're getting stronger somewhere. So we like to keep numbers on all that and just try to push things where we're able to push them. And if not, then we at least like to maintain. But if we have those numbers there, then we always know what guys are capable of doing on every exercise that we throw at them in the weight room. And when it comes to tracking power data, you know, we're looking at a myriad of different jumping exercises. So we have a Just Jump mat, and we try to track the height on any type of jump we're doing, whether it's bilateral, unilateral, resisted, unresisted, whatever. We're trying to get a jump height on every type of jump that we're doing. Or if we're doing a horizontal jump, we like to get the distance of every jump that we're doing. So we try to measure those all the time as well, and we'll measure the distances of throws, and we'll take the time as well, just for the sake of getting a little bit more objective. We'll take the peak and average power output of those jumps. So we'll take our jump heights that we've achieved on a certain exercise, and we'll plug them into the Harman formula. And that allows us to get a little bit of a better idea of what their average and peak power outputs are on those jumping exercises. So it takes into account the athlete's body mass. So we're not just looking at just one performance variable. Now we're able to look at how that is relative to their body size as well. So get a better idea of what their true power output capabilities are. And we'll do different types of index testing just for my own curiosity. I'm trying to play with and just see what type of trends I can look at. So we have those push bands as well that can help us track certain qualities. So we'll put the push band on our guys and we'll look at their reactive strength index using drills like the 10-5 pogo test, where they'll do 10 pogo jumps, trying to minimize ground contact as much as possible. So it's more about how fast they can get off the ground than it is how high they can get, and just kind of see what their variables are for that. We'll do the same thing with drop jump testing as well. So just dropping them from a 12 to 18, maybe 24 inch height, and just seeing what their reactive strength index is at those different levels, and just get a better idea of their plyometric capabilities. And we'll even look at the explosive strength deficit too, where we're looking at their counter movement jump versus their squat jump with a 3-second pause at the bottom and then exploding up, and just trying to see, it'll help give us an idea of if they're a little bit better at producing higher force qualities, or if they might need more work, you know, if they need more work for reactive drills, or if they need more work that are strength oriented drills. And these are all things that I'm still trying to figure out exactly how I want to use them. But right now I'm just looking at them with all of our athletes and just collecting them as we go, and just trying to see what type of trends we can get from doing these things, and if they make sense or not. And if they do, we're going to keep them. And if they don't, we'll just kind of get rid of them. For all of our speed training, we try to make sure, you know, once their technique is safe and somewhat efficient, where we feel that they're comfortable to perform sprint work without much coaching, that's when we start really timing everything. And we use the Brouwer timing system with that TC motion start. So that gives us the ability to have the timing system start on their motion, start when the system detects them moving by. So that's great for like flying sprints. If they build up for, you know, 20 yards and then they run through the detection and the timing starts for the second 20 yard split. And you can also have an option on there where you can do a reaction start where it beeps and the athlete has to start on that beep, and the timing system will start when the system beeps. So it takes into account reaction time as well. So we like to get different data from using different forms of those as well. And it just allows us to see different splits on different sprints, and we'll use that timing system for whatever we're doing. So if we start from weird positions, it doesn't matter. Like we're always trying to get some type of timing variable on sprint drills so that they have something that they need to constantly push and try to get faster on and beat their old personal records as well. I would say the biggest thing that I need to do more research on is just being able to conduct tests that make sense to me for endurance testing. So we've done a lot of where we'll ask them what type of things they'll be tested on with their teams, and then we try to make sure that they're prepped for that. But I also want to make sure that we create a system of testing parameters where we can look at all kinds of different endurance capabilities. So we've played around in the past with using a beep test and using the Eurofit method that I read on Mladen Jovanovic's site, that Dan Baker was talking about, where it's kind of like a maximal aerobic speed method. You know, we've played with some of those different things, but we've also, with our football players, we do a lot of tempo running, you know, where we're doing, and they're trying to keep them around their 75% of their average maximum sprinting speed. So when we do longer sprints with the guys, we make sure we time that, and then we look at their average speed, yards per second, based off. So we convert it to meters and yards per second. But that allows us to see what 75% of their maximum sprinting speed is, and that allows us to see what type of time interval they should achieve a certain distance in. So we tell them, you know, this is right around where you want to be, no matter what the distance is. So you want to make, you know, a 60-yard tempo in this or a 100-yard tempo in this time, and it's based off their sprinting performance. And I would say, you know, the biggest thing that we definitely need to research is developing some sort of quantifiable movement assessment profile or something that we can do where we're able to quantify their mobility. That's something that I need to do a lot more research into, and I need to figure out what makes most sense for me. And I know that the FRC system, they're coming out with one called the functional range assessment. So that's something that I might look into. And we've also been fortunate to do some work with 1080 Motion, because they are They have a couple people in Austin that work with them, even though they're based out in Sweden. They have some people in Austin as well, and they have the 1080 movement assessment profile. So that's something I'm inquiring about as well with the people from 1080 Motion. But that, I would say, that's the biggest area that I want to move into next, is trying to quantify mobility and figure out how to really measure improvements when it comes to joint mobility.
Cameron, one thing you just mentioned is 1080 Motion. And I know that Carl Valle has been discussing this and tweeting about it. He's also reached out to me privately. And it's an area that I've wanted to learn more about. And I think a lot of listeners would benefit from it. So could you tell us a little bit about 1080 and specifically the 1080 Quantum, which you're using down at DeFranco? So how do you utilize it, what it is, and what benefits you've seen from it?
So the 1080 system, they have two products. The first one is the Quantum, which is more of their global training device that is for power, speed, and strength training all in one system. And then they also have the 1080 Sprint, which is primarily used for sprinting and just power development and more of a horizontal plane. And they also use that device with swimmers, which is pretty cool. So the best thing, the greatest advantage I would say about the 1080 devices is that they utilize advanced robotic technology that just makes movements very, very smooth. And I'll get into more about sort of the details on that. But I would say the greatest advantage of the system is that now you truly have something that you can perform very, very specific sports movements against very subtle and customizable resistance. So the awesome thing about both the Quantum and the Sprint devices is that they can be used to really overload anything you want to do. Like the guys from 1080 Motion, they basically, when they let us borrow the system, is that they said, you just need to get creative with it, come up with stuff. You know, we don't even know the capabilities of this thing. That's why we're trying to get coaches to learn more about it. And we want guys to play with it. So just get creative with it. And it's cool because you can actually set the load on the system. It's basically just a cable system by appearance, but it's much more than that. So it's something where it uses robotic technology where you can,
so you can independently set the concentric versus the eccentric resistance of any movement. So if you're an American football player and you get on the device where the cable is pulling you towards the machine, you can set it where the resistance it's pulling you is set at maybe 16 kilograms of resistance. But when you cut back, going back out towards the field, now you're only going against like 8 kilograms of resistance or whatever you want to set it to. So you can make the eccentric resistance greater than the concentric. And that's something that you can't do that with any weight room device or any type of exercise in any other form of real life other than what this machine is capable of doing. So it really allows, it has huge application for any change of direction sport and even throwing sports where you can sort of, you can add a very subtle eccentric resistance to it. So it gets throwers a little bit more efficient on that eccentric part before, you know, the opposite motion of a throwing motion. And the other cool thing that the Sprint device can do is you can set the machine to give you a given load until you've achieved a certain speed or a certain distance, and then the resistance will unload, and all of a sudden now you have an unloaded sprint. So you can be resisted for, let's say, 10 meters against like 8 kilos of resistance, and then once the system realizes that you're at 10 meters, now you're unloaded and you're just sprinting. So it's pretty cool from a potentiation standpoint, and just the capabilities of these devices are seemingly endless. And the great thing about the devices is that they give you peak and average force, peak and average power, and peak and average velocity data on every set of every rep of every exercise that you do. So what I think that allows for is now you have a new variable to measure strength, because you can actually see force output. So if you want to measure rotational force for, let's say, a baseball player who's trying to hit, or an MMA athlete that has to do plenty of rotational movements in their sport, now you can actually quantify their force output in a rotational movement, because it's giving you the actual force in newtons on the screen at peak and average during any movement that you want. Really the bigger quality in that standpoint is the average power or the average force output over the course of the range of motion, but it gives you a different variable to quantify it other than just the load being lifted like you would use in the weight room to measure that. And really any movement can be quantified that you can think of. You just have to get creative and figure out what you want to hook up to the machine and how you want to use it. Having the numbers in real time will allow you to have that instant feedback that you can give to athletes if you want to. So you have the instant feedback of performance. Okay, your power output was this amount of watts on that rotational movement or whatever the movement that you're doing, or even that jump or that sprint. Now I want you to try to beat that number. So they're getting real-time feedback. And the other cool feature of it is the isokinetic resistance, because a lot of isokinetic research is really based on single joint movements. So there's not a lot of research where you're looking at complex movement patterns, and that's something, or even just multi-joint movements. That's something that this device allows for researchers to utilize, is they can look at how does isokinetic resistance affect strength output when now you're looking at something more than just a single joint exercise. And the cool thing about 1080 is they've actually designed training guidelines based on this isokinetic resistance. So when I say isokinetic, for anybody that's confused as to what it is it's basically because you can alter the speed of the cable using the computer system, you can set it to where the cable's not going to move any faster than, let's say, like 0.5 meters per second. So you could put zero force into it or virtually hardly any force into it. You can't put zero because then it wouldn't move, but you can put just barely any force into it. It'll still move at 0.5 meters per second, or you can put as much force as you possibly can into it and it's still going to move at the same speed. So visually the same speed is going to happen, but whether or not you're going as hard as you can on it will be very different. So, but they have training guidelines based on how long the cable stretches and what type of settings you should set it to. Like one of the examples is if your movement requires a meter of range of motion, then you would set that to 0.5 meters per second on the concentric speed settings. And now you can train for maximum force development where you're trying to get as much force as you possibly can throughout that range of motion. And they have what they refer to as the no flyweight setting for power training, which is another huge and amazing feature of the devices, is that basically what it does is if you're doing something like, let's say, a broad jump against the resistance of the cable, it's going to give you that sense of inertia that's still there, but the cable is not going to produce any slack. So if you hooked a cable, just a regular cable stack to you, a couple things would happen is, A, when you're jumping out, the cable would produce some slack. And then when it finally goes taut, you're going to have that snap of the cable. So you could probably break the cable if you try to do a broad jump with cable resistance. The other thing is that the resistance is the same going out as it is going back in, and the speed of, like, whatever speed you're putting out, it's pulling you back with that too. But with this machine, is like now you can control those variables. So with the no flyweight setting, you can the cable remains taut throughout the range of motion. So it basically results in what they refer to as a shock-free feeling. So you can do multiple repetitions of a power movement, and you don't have that sense of like that jolt that you would have from like a cable stack or from doing barbells or whatever. It's very, very smooth. And there's really no other way to talk about it other than like you just have to feel it. So it's a pretty cool feature that they have. And it really just allows you to produce power in very controlled environments. And the other thing you can do is you can set the eccentric speed development. So if you want to go as hard as you can and see your power of a rotational swing or a broad jump, but you don't want the cable to pull you back, you just set the speed on the eccentric phase lower, so the cable will be pulled back in very slowly. So now you can go out as hard as you want, and it's going to pull you back slowly and under control. It's not going to yank you back towards the machine. So it makes for a lot of creativity, and it's a pretty cool machine that we've been very fortunate to be able to test and utilize.
What athletes have you tested the 1080 Quantum with? And then in terms of where does it fit within your program design? I know this is going to vary depending on what block you're in with these athletes, but how have you been able to integrate it perhaps in a power block?
One of the things I just finished doing was a 4-week case study with one of my NHL players. His name's Chad Rewettel. He just signed with the Pittsburgh Penguins. And we did one day of force basically training for force on one day and then training for power on the other day. And what we did was just sort of like a mini experiment where before we started the experiment, I used one of the push bands and I put it on his arm and I had him do a slap shot motion and just did like a free movement velocity just to measure what his average velocity. And I specifically instructed to him to do it within the same technique he would do it. So I didn't tell him to swing it as hard as he could. I just said, just swing like you would swing if you're trying to score a goal, you know, or trying to hit a slap shot. So we did that in sort of the pre-testing. I think he averaged out at 4.61 meters per second, just free movement velocity. And then we just did a 4-week program where we were training force on one day and then power on the other day. And the force day was always, we were always training isokinetic with that same slap shot type of movement. So we were training isokinetically with that. And I was just telling him to try to keep it as coordinatively similar as he could. And, you know, just, I don't know what it means really with the data, but you know, he was able to achieve about 256 Newtons doing that. And then we would test his peak power, average power, and also peak and average velocity against resistance in that slap shot movement. So we did 2 weeks against 6 kilograms of resistance and then 2 weeks against 8 kilograms of resistance. And this was all just doing the slap shot motion. So where we kind of filtered that in was on more upper body dominant days, even though it's sort of a full body movement, it requires a lot from the torso and the upper body. So we put that into his upper body days and we would do it right at the beginning of his workout. And then we would just do everything else afterwards. So it still fit very smoothly into what he was doing. But after the 4 weeks, it was, you know, it was interesting because when we retested his just free movement velocity with the push band, with the same instructions, just telling him to do it, you know, the same, just do it how you would do it on the field or on the ice. His post-testing was 5.48 meters per second. So that was, he went from 4.61 to 5.48 average velocity of just pretty much just casually just hitting the stick. So he had like, without him even realizing it, he achieved an 18.9% increase in his just free movement slap shot velocity. So it was kind of interesting. And again, I don't really know what it all means, but it gives indication that something happened. And, you know, I'm going to try to write up more formally kind of what I did with him and present it to 1080 and just kind of show them what we did. But that's basically the extent of what I've done with it so far. And I've used it a little bit with some of my NFL guys, just trying to work against the eccentric overload and doing more movement oriented things like shuffling and cutting out of shuffles against the resistance and just trying to expose and just experiment with different sort of procedures on there. Because again, there's so little information involved with the 1080 devices right now that they're just encouraging everybody to be creative with it. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I just try to see like what kind of improvements can be made from it and what type of time frame. And I think there's a lot of implications for it. And like I said, they have training guidelines, whether you want to train for strength, hypertrophy, power, you know, they actually have those developed right now. And they have a guy, Ollie, that works for them in Sweden, who's sort of the mastermind behind their training. And I got on Skype call with him and he gave me some tips and guidelines of how to set the machine up. And, you know, they've been experimenting with it for a while, but there's still a ton of research that needs to be done with them. So, you know, anybody that's capable of getting one, I recommend getting one and just trying to get creative with it.
Cameron, the way I always like to end my podcast, because there's a lot of individuals that are just starting out their career who listen to the Historic Performance Podcast, and now you find yourself in a setting where you're the director of sports performance at a private facility. And early on, right at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioned a conversation that you had with Joe DeFranco where you weren't sure if you're going to go down the college S&C route or the private route. And he looked at the pros and he kind of evaluated the pros and the cons with you. So for individuals that eventually want to go down the private sector, what would be some recommendations you would have for them, both in terms of evaluating and what you specifically look for in interns or entry-level hires at DeFranco?
I would say the biggest thing is you need to educate yourself as much as possible. And you really need to take the education very seriously, because the private sector is a field where there's people, basically anybody can start a gym and open one up with, if they have the money to do it, and they can claim that they're an expert. So it's not like the collegiate or the professional setting where they have to have a resume that kind of proves what they're capable of doing to some degree. Anybody can open up a gym and just start claiming that they train athletes. So I think that if you're very serious about getting things done with the athletes, you have to educate yourself to the highest degree. And school is not enough. Like, if you come out from school and you're like, I know everything, you don't. I mean, there's so much that you don't know. It's actually hilarious how much you don't know. So you have to really educate yourself by just talking to people and reading everything you can see. So, I mean, you have to also network and talk to people, because if you're just reading and you're never talking and sharing ideas with people, you're not going to learn much from that. You're not going to grow from that. So I think definitely the continuing education is huge, and always doing that, no matter what. You can never get comfortable with that, because science is such an advancing field every day. Science is constantly progressing all the time. So you really need to make sure that you're staying on top of things. And that's where, you know, there's people out there that put stuff out there. You go on Twitter or any kind of social media, people share all the information. It's just up to you to go out there and find it. You need to have that drive to do that. So that's definitely stage one. Stage two is just, don't pigeonhole yourself. Like I said before, don't polarize yourself to being, I'm the speed guy, I'm the strength guy, I'm the endurance guy. Like, that, all that makes no sense, because the human body is just so complex, and it's just everything that goes into it is just so holistic. You need to educate yourself across a wide different things, and don't polarize your thinking. Really take a whole complementary approach with everything that you do. And also make sure that you check your ego at the door. So that's one of the biggest things we look for when we're looking at guys that we want to work with and we want to be involved with. If they're one of those know-it-all guys that has an ego that's, you know, as big as the Empire State Building, we want nothing to do with them. We don't want to talk to them. We don't care to be involved with them, because we know that they're not going to help us grow. We want to be involved with people that are humble, that are going to help us grow, that are going to take what we can teach them and then take it a step further and teach us. So, you know, we don't want just these guys that think they know everything. So that's the other thing, is if you think you know everything, you don't, because even the guys that know the most are the first ones to admit that they don't know everything or even anything. So definitely checking the ego out the door, and also just knowing that you're there to over deliver. Like we said before, you have to make sure that you're always ready to over deliver to the client. Again, whether or not the client knows it, you need to make sure that you're doing everything for them that's in their best interest. They could think you're doing a great job, and really you're doing a half-assed job. So you have to be able to look into the mirror and be honest with yourself and know if you're giving that person what, if you're providing them with what they deserve, which is to really reach their goal. Because if they're coming to you, you have to make sure that you're giving them a product that is sufficient enough for them to reach their goal, and do so in a safe manner and do so in a reasonable manner. And so that's the other, I would say that all of those combined is really what I would recommend for anybody that's young trying to get into the private sector. Is it's just a constant learning process, and constantly just trying to make sure that you're putting yourself in a position to grow and achieve just great things and really do great work.
Cameron, if anyone has any questions about anything that you brought up in the podcast, or just wants to get together at some point and talk on Skype and share ideas, what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
They can reach out to me on my social media. On Facebook, it's just my name, Cameron Josse, Josse. And on Instagram and Twitter, my name is at CamJosse. So it's just at Cam Josse. And, you know, anybody can follow me or send me a message on those, and I'll do my best to respond, and relatively easy to get in contact with. And I'm always down to talk about anything that's going to help me grow and help other people grow. I love to teach as much as I love to learn. So, you know, I encourage anybody that's interested to talk to me about anything can reach out to me, and I'd love to start conversations with as many people as I can.
Cameron, I just want to say that it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this Tuesday evening. And I've been scribbling notes the entire time when you've been talking, and at least the areas where you've talked about 1080, how you utilize 1080 quantum, the case study, and as well as FRC has been very insightful, and something that I'm going to look into myself. And I hope that it's been very insightful to listeners as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been great being on the podcast.
All right, Cameron, have a good night. Thanks again for listening to another Historic Performance podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to head over to iTunes to leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show. I'll see you guys next week.